Reverend Kusala lives and works in at the International Buddhist Meditation Center in Koreatown. He leads weekly meditation and discussion groups at the center and gives presentations at local high schools, colleges, and churches on Buddhism and social action. He feeds 24 cats every day, and it takes a long time, and it's a little bit of a meditation. I did it once. And they all have a special place that they like to eat, and he goes, "Don't put that bowl there. No one will eat there." The cats mostly love him. He's a great musician, and he's my ukulele buddy. Please welcome Reverend Kusala Bhikshu.
Thank you, Wendy. I'm happy to be here. I'm going to talk about where compassion comes from today. You probably already know this, but may not have heard it put in the way I'm about to do it. But before I do that, I'm going to play a song for you. And this is a song that I found on YouTube. And I really like the song, but I needed to change some of the words. And so I changed some of the words, and then I changed the key the song was in, and then I changed some of the chords. And so it's almost like the original song, but I changed it to make it appropriate for me. Now, if you're a Buddhist or a secular humanist or an atheist or just a good person who maybe didn't find the traditional religion, this song may speak to you. And if not, it may still speak to you. And the title of the song is "Jesus Doesn't Want Me, and the Devil, He Don't Care." Jesus doesn't want me, and the devil, he don't care. God is in his heaven, and the Holy Spirit's out there somewhere. Buddha just sits and he smiles so kindly. I just figured it out, and finally, Jesus doesn't want me, and the devil, well, he don't care. Jesus wants to save my soul. Satan wants it too. Devil and an angel sitting on a shoulder, telling me just what to do. One on the left says, "Do the right thing." The one on the other says, "To hell with him." How am I to know which one to do? Jesus doesn't want me, and the devil, he don't care. God is in his heaven, and the Holy Spirit's out there somewhere. Buddha just sits and he smiles so kindly. I just figured it out, and finally, Jesus doesn't want me, and the devil, well, he don't care. All my life I've tried my best to win and never lose, but no one sits on shoulders. I've always had to choose. When I found the Buddha way, I lost all fearful thought. With mind so still, heart so full, never to get caught. Now I know which way I am to choose. Jesus doesn't want me, and the devil, he don't care. God is in his heaven, and the Holy Spirit's out there somewhere. Buddha just sits, so he smiles so kindly. I just figured it out, and finally, Jesus doesn't want me, and the devil, well, he don't care. Jesus doesn't want me, and the devil, well, he don't care. There we go. Thank you, thank you. Now, where does compassion come from? And if you're like
a lot of us and tend to volunteer or be concerned, you might wonder why the heck you're doing it, because you're suffering from compassion fatigue. And somebody else says, can you help? And you say, yes, but you really don't want to. And yet you are changing the lives of many humans and others on this planet because something drives you. Now, in the early Buddhist tradition of the Theravada, the doctrine of the elders, the more orthodox approach to the teachings of the Buddha, there was a heavy emphasis on wisdom. It was more like a therapy, perhaps, than a religion. And the idea was this, that life ultimately sucks. And the Buddha, in his wisdom and clarity, said, I have discovered why life is ultimately unsatisfactory, and I have discovered the answer and the way to the end of this unsatisfactoriness. So people were working on themselves. They were trying to end their suffering and come to a place of peace and balance. And then, out of their nirvana, they would help others also end their suffering. Now, for a long time, Buddhists weren't really known as being socially engaged. There wasn't much of a reason for Buddhists to get out of the temple because the whole emphasis was on changing the way you experience the world. The Buddha said the world is just the way it is. You can give it a value of good or bad, but if you try to change the world, you will surely fail. But if you try to change the way you experience the world, you may succeed. Shantideva, a famous bodhisattva, once wrote, you know, why cover the world with a piece of leather so you won't feel the pebbles? Wouldn't it be better to simply buy a pair of shoes? And so as I thought about the early Buddhist tradition, they were all buying shoes. And the ones that couldn't afford them, well, we'd get to them sooner or later. Now, around the first century, Buddhism changed dramatically. It was the reform movement of Buddhism. It went from the Theravada, the doctrine of the elders, to the Mahayana, the great vehicle. Room for everyone. Get on board. Okay. And they said, it's best not to work on yourself in the way the Theravada do, because they're selfish, apparently. They're only concerned about their own shoes, not yours. We want to have shoes for everybody. And we're going to postpone getting our shoes until everybody else has theirs. What a wonderful, joyful message that was. And there were bodhisattvas, these Buddhist saints, and we had the bodhisattva of compassion and wisdom. We even have a bodhisattva for hell. So if any of you end up there, check him out. He'll be glad to help. But where does this come from? Why would they be more interested in helping others than helping themselves? And I think it came out of the change of goal. In the early Buddhist tradition of Theravada, the goal was nirvana. In the later Buddhist tradition of Mahayana, the goal was enlightenment. Enlightenment. Now, you may have heard both these words, nirvana and enlightenment, used in the same sentence. They seem to mean the same thing until you start to think about it, and then the description of enlightenment and the results seem to be a bit different. If you're enlightened, it does not end your suffering. If you're enlightened, it does not end your karma. Nirvana, it does. If you achieve enlightenment, you don't end your future rebirths. In fact, there's something called the bodhisattva ideal, where you choose to come back as a human being, time and time again, to be of service to all sentient beings. So enlightenment. My definition of nirvana is the end of suffering, the end of karma, the end of all future rebirths. My definition of enlightenment is the interconnectedness and interdependence of all phenomena, a direct experience of the interconnectedness and interdependence of all phenomena. And there are meditation techniques designed to get you there, to come to a place of the present moment experience of your life, to come to a place where past and future no longer exist. Yesterday morning, I found myself at Leisure World. And I go to Leisure World once a month now in Seal Beach. We have something called the Buddhist Circle. To be honest with you, the first time I went to Leisure World, I was a little apprehensive because you know who lives in Leisure World? Old people. And I thought to myself, I don't know if I want to be around all these old people. And then I looked around the room, and you know what? They were all me. And I was them. And we had a lot of shared experiences. They knew who the Rolling Stones were. They were there when they started. How cool was that? And we started the talk yesterday, and one of the fellows came with a book, and he read a paragraph from the book, and he said, I'd like you to comment on this. And the book was about death and dying. And he said, do Buddhists talk about dying a lot? Do they talk about death a lot? And I said, all the time. Because you really can't live well until you figure out how to die well. Now, that may sound a little depressing, but I'm talking to people who are looking towards the end. And they're figuring out, well, how am I going to do it? What do I have to look forward to? It's a little fearful to pass in this life. And I said, well, no, actually, it's pretty good. Because by the time you get to be 70, 80 years old, that body just doesn't work like it used to. You may have a hearing aid in one ear. You may have gone from single vision to bifocals to trifocals. You may not even know the people you're talking to. They look familiar, but you're never sure. And the joy about dying is you get to give this life up, a well-used life, and start the next one. If you're a Buddhist, if you're Christian, you got eternity ahead. Can't get better than that. And you know what? Dogs always go to heaven. I just wanted to share that with you. So as we come to this present moment experience in meditation, what we're literally doing is dying into the present moment of our life. We're letting go of our past and our future. We're letting go of who we need to be or who we should be. And we're coming to a transcendent place where our individuality falls away, where our separateness is no longer separate. We are embraced by the universe. Arms surround us. It's a nice picture. We don't have arms in Buddhism, we have emptiness, but I just wanted to add that. And there you are, no longer the person you thought you were or should be, and you find that you are directly interconnected and interdependent to everyone else out there. It changes you. It breaks your heart, never to mend again. It's that enlightenment experience that gives you the urgency in your life to be of service to others, because the other is you, and you are the other. Until you've had that experience, you're simply practicing. It's good to help. It's good to volunteer. But once you've had that experience, you can't turn away. You may never be able to take a vacation again. Where do you go where no one suffers? Hawaii? How about those sunburns? My gosh. So now you look around, and you are called into service, not because it's the right thing to do, and it very well may be, but because you understand you can be an agent to reduce or end suffering for others. So you're not doing it to change the world. You're doing it to change the suffering. Taking suffering and turning it into happiness or joy. Or even better, peace. Can we be at peace in every situation we find ourselves in? All you have to do is look at the news and wonder, why? Why do we still go to war? Isn't that the dumbest thing? I think. You know, a lot of people die needlessly for that. You know, and somebody gave me a movie called Genesis. Nothing to do with the Bible. But it's a movie on evolution, and it was really cool. It showed, like, the earth in this dramatic setting of fire, and then there was water, and then there were little creatures crawling out of the ocean, and those creatures turned into other creatures, and they turned into other creatures, and finally we have so many living things on this earth. But you know what the first thing those little creatures did? It really bummed me out, is they killed the other creatures because they were hungry. They needed to eat. Ever since life was generated on this earth, for whatever reason, the first thing we did was kill. So we could protect ourselves, so we could eat, so we could be strong. And what's the second thing we did? We had sex. And then we ate again. Have we changed very much since those little creatures walked out of the ocean? And when I came to the teachings of the Buddha and I received the five precepts, I said, this is remarkable. The first precept for Buddhists is not to take life. Going against everything that's ingrained, that's imprinted on us. Not to take life. Not to take what is not given. Not to indulge in sexual misconduct. Not to lie and undermine the reality of those you're talking to. Not to consume intoxicants. To cherish clarity and wisdom. We have the ability as human beings to go against our natural way of being in this world, which is killing and replicating and dying. Okay. For some, that may be enough. But for others, to transcend that and become skillful, encourage life rather than take life, instead of stealing to practice generosity like you just did before I came up here, instead of having sex, now this is going to sound really weird, to practice celibacy. I'm not encouraging you to practice celibacy. Some practice because they want to. Some practice because of circumstance. But eventually we all find ourselves there for a while. Is that a bad thing or a good thing? How do you look at people when you're practicing celibacy? What kind of relationships do you form with them? You know, when you don't want to be lustful, when you simply want to be in love with them. How does that change? So what I started to see about this enlightenment thing is it allows us to find our heart. It allows us to come home again after being separate for all those years because of ego and self. A necessary component of our life is ego and self because this world is a very complicated world to live in. And we can't be one with the door and function. If you're one with the door, you'll never leave. There's no place to exit or entrance. So we need to be separate most of our life in order to function. But those moments of spiritual awareness, those epiphany moments of maybe walking on the beach at sunset, and for some reason, in that one moment, the sand that's caressing your feet and the sound of the waves lapping against the shore and the setting sun, that orange glow, for some reason, you know you're part of that. It's your inheritance. And then, sure enough, bang, you're back on the beach, wondering where the local bar is so you can have a beer and enjoy the sunset, you know. But we all have those moments. Most of us are so busy doing other things that we don't recognize them. But if we practice meditation, meditation can be the practice of heart. And when the heart breaks and we have the direct experience of the interconnectedness and interdependence of all phenomena, we are no longer separate. And we always have something to do. To be of service to the ones who aren't there yet, or to be of service to the ones that are hungry and homeless and confused. It won't make your life better. It just gives you more to do. That's the irony of the whole thing. True compassion, there's no payoff. When I go out and feed my 24 cats every day, do you think they care? They expect me to be there. They expect their food. And then what do? They leave. They got places to go and things to do. So there is this unconditional giving and sharing that goes on, expecting nothing in return. That's the true sign of compassion. And at the root of that compassion is something that's important, one of the most important things in Buddhism and perhaps in other religions as well, and that is kindness. If you can do nothing else in your life other than be kind, you're a saint. How difficult that is, to be kind in every situation. Yeah. So love through kindness eventually turns into compassionate activity, which eventually reduces the suffering of the world. And then you die. But a life well lived. Thank you for coming to listen to me speak. Now we have something special we're going to do right now. A young fellow came to me as we were sitting outside and said, "I'm so glad you're here because you play blues harmonica." And I said, "Well, I actually brought my ukulele today. I'm going to do a song." And he seemed disappointed. So we're going to play a little blues to end this talk. And what does the blues do? Well, it makes people who aren't feeling so good, a little suffering, feel even better about their life and the world. So if I can ask for accompaniment, here we go. Thank you.